Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
When white settlement first occurred in Australia, back in 1788, of course the country was occupied. We all know that. There were Aborigines here. But what happened to them? And in particular, what happened to them in and around the coastal areas of Sydney? For some reason, of course, they don't really appear in the historical record, not very much, apart from standouts perhaps like Bennelong and some others. But what actually did comprise the Aboriginal population of coastal Sydney when white settlers first arrived? And more importantly, what happened to them? Well, some might say, well, they all just died off or disappeared or something of that nature, which is common enough, I suppose, when writing the Aboriginal story. Paul Irish has gone back to have a look at what happened and discovered that the more you dig, the more you find. And he's written a very interesting book called Hidden in Plain View about the Aboriginal community, where they were, what they did, how they interacted, how they lived, and discovers, perhaps not unsurprisingly, that they didn't disappear at all. Anyway, he joins us in the studio. Paul, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Yes, thanks for having me.
How many do you think were here? What comprised the Aboriginal population of Sydney and its coastal region when Philip first dropped the anchor?
Well, we're obviously relying on some fairly shifty guesswork by the early colonists, but the accepted figure is somewhere around 1,000, 1,500 people that would have comprised around, been living around Sydney Harbour, Botany Bay, that sort of coastal part of Sydney. Mm-hmm. We don't know more precisely than that, but there certainly was a lot of people around, and early pictures, for example, show flotillas of canoes out on the harbour, people fishing and large gatherings of people around the harbour. So we know that there was quite a lot of people, many families.
I'm surprised in a sense, so few though, like you say, 1,000 to 1,500. This is across what's quite a big area of coastline when you include the harbour and Botany Bay and all of that.
Yeah, that's true. I guess part of that is that Aboriginal people were moving around, and so that's also one of the reasons why we're sort of guessing a bit about that population. But these were very rich fishing grounds around the coast and also very sought-after places to live, but that appears to have been the population, something of that magnitude. Mm. Yeah.
So, well, tell me the story. What happened?
Well, I think a lot of people would be familiar with people like you mentioned there at the start, Bennelong, and some of these early figures
that put up a fight.
Yeah, that we've heard of in the early years. But many people also know that just over a year after the first fleet arrived, there was an absolutely catastrophic smallpox epidemic that radiated out from Sydney and really killed. Again, we're guessing at how many people lost their lives, but we're certainly talking about every single family in the Sydney area being affected and possibly losing, you know, entire families. And we're familiar with those things, and then we're also familiar with the story moving forward of Sydney expanding from a little tent town in Sydney Cove to become the city that we know it today. And that history has always been perceived as one of Aboriginal people sort of getting out of the way of that expanding city.
And yeah, well, I think about it myself because, I mean, I read a lot about it. They're not in the story at all.
They're not in the stories that have been written sort of in the last 100 years. But you know, one of the fantastic things that's happened in the last 10 or 20 years is a lot of newspapers and things going online, and you can search them. Whereas it might have taken a historian a lifetime to search the Sydney Morning Herald, you can now peruse it at your leisure online. And what you can do from that is start to pick out these tiny little snippets of information about Aboriginal people. And when you put all of that information together, you start to see this population appear in the historical records. You can see where they lived, you can see where they moved, you can tell there's a lot of things that we can't know, but we can certainly see that they were there and where they were living and how they were living. And
tell me about that.
Well, so
where were they living and how were they living?
So not surprisingly, the First Fleet recorded the reliance of Aboriginal people around the coast on the resources of the sea, of fish and shellfish and other things. And that remained the case, arguably, to this day for people up and down the coast and around Sydney. And certainly through the 19th century, Aboriginal people were not only still fishing and using wooden fishing boats that they'd obtained from the English, but they were also, in some cases, commercial fishermen. and fisherwomen, and they were also running tours. They were the acknowledged experts in Sydney at reading the seas and knowing when the fish were running.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to maintain living for themselves by doing that, and also sell fish to obtain the other things that they needed.
By this stage, by what, 1830, 1840, how many people are we talking about by then?
What we see in the records throughout most of the 19th century in the area that I would describe as coastal Sydney, sort of Sydney Harbour, Botany Bay, and a little bit further south, is 50 to 100 Aboriginal people.
Right.
So it's not a lot, but it's really important to see that these people, in many cases, were also linked further up and down the coast. So they were drawing on a population in terms of marrying and moving around of a larger number of people than that. But at any one time, we rarely find that there are more than about 100 people in Sydney, in coastal Sydney, at any one time.
Did they live in one place, or where did they live?
No, they moved around. I think, you know, one of the things that's the theme of this book with the title Hidden in Plain View is it's not just that Aboriginal people have been hidden in plain view. The history of Sydney in many ways is hidden, particularly if we think about an area like the eastern suburbs. We see it now carpeted with what we see as heritage houses. But if you go back, say, 100, 120 years, there was really only a few large colonial estates there. There was a lot of space in between, and certainly Aboriginal people could continue to live in virtually every bay of the eastern suburbs right up until the late 19th century. Mm. And they did.
And they did.
Mm. Yeah, so there was, for example, an Aboriginal settlement that we can trace from the 1840s and probably much earlier, right through to 1899, 1900, and those people then moved to a fishing village at La Perouse.
Mm. Tell us about La Perouse, because that's a well-known place of Aboriginal community.
Yeah, and
in Sydney. What's the history of that?
It's a place that's sort of had a myth around it that everyone that's in La Perouse has come from somewhere else, and usually from the south coast. And there's elements of truth to that, because there's certainly historically over the last 100 years people have come from a lot of different places. But it goes back to this idea of people in coastal Sydney having these linkages up and down the coast. And when we look a bit deeper at the people who established La Perouse in the late 1870s, we find that they were actually people that had linkages to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And La Perouse was established by Aboriginal people as a fishing village, a place that they'd been using for fishing for many years, thousands of years, but also right since the start of Europeans being in Sydney. But it evolved into a permanent settlement that became an Aboriginal mission. Because at the very time that it was established, the government started to intervene in Aboriginal affairs. They'd basically done nothing and had no input directly into the affairs of Aboriginal people in Sydney for about half a century before that time.
Mm.
But they started to intervene, and so did missionaries. And so you end up with a settlement like La Perouse, which really looked like a lot of the other settlements I've mentioned, Rushcutters Bay, Vaucluse, other places where Aboriginal people were living. But by around 1900 and the early 1900s, La Perouse was the biggest and one of the only settlements left around coastal Sydney, because the government had started to put pressure on Aboriginal people to live in particular places and not live in others.
Hmm. Okay. And places like Redfern in Sydney, which of course become in later years and perhaps in the 20th century, a place where Aboriginal people live and have community. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, Redfern and the block that everyone would have heard of have functioned in a similar way to what La Perouse did maybe half a century before, in that it became a bit of a beachhead for Aboriginal people coming from other places. It was a place where they could find family.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there were Aboriginal people living in Redfern, you know, throughout the 20th century, but by about the 1920s or 30s, there's a really core population of Aboriginal people living there, and that just starts to grow, and particularly after the Second World War.
Mm.
There was a lot of migration into Sydney, and that's when the block as we know it today and certainly the surrounding areas had a huge Aboriginal population.
I'm talking with Paul Irish. He's an historian, and he's written a book called Hidden in Plain View, which has gone back to original sources to try and uncover the story of Aboriginal people post-white settlement in and around the Sydney coastal area, in Botany Bay, in Sydney Harbour, and what happened to them. They didn't conveniently all just disappear with the disappearance of Benelong, for example. So what did they interact? Was there interaction with the white community in the 19th century? Or were they shunned? And, you know, there's probably a popular view that they lived some sort of wretched fringe life.
Absolutely.
Is that how it was?
No, and I think this is probably one of the major findings of my book is to really chart the relationships that developed over many years often between white and black in Sydney. It's not to paint a rosy picture. I'm sure that many people still suffered at the hands of some of the Europeans in Sydney, but there was a significant number who developed relationships, and particularly and crucially for the Aboriginal people of coastal Sydney, it was the children of convicts that they got to know in the very early years of the colony that grew up and by the 1830s and 1840s were lawyers and businessmen and councillors, parliamentarians, newspaper editors, and they were quite wealthy and influential, and they owned properties across the eastern suburbs. Mm. And it was often around those places that Aboriginal people were living, and they had relationships that lasted, in some cases, through three or four generations with those families.
Can you put names and lives to some of these people?
Yeah. So, for example, the Wentworth family that are associated with Vaucluse House, which you can still visit today as a historic house, in that the estate that the Wentworth family owned covered most of the modern suburb of Vaucluse. And there were Aboriginal people living across their estate. There was a man named William Worrell who lived at Rose Bay and died in about 1863. And William Charles Wentworth, who was the famous Wentworth and parliamentarian, knew William Worrell personally, as he did a number of other people. And when William Worrell was sick towards the end of his life, both William Charles Wentworth and some of his other neighbours organised for him to be looked after in his hut by South Head Road.
Mm-hmm.
And after he died, the Wentworths had an Aboriginal man living with them as a servant, and other Aboriginal people were living around the property and trading fish with the Wentworths and other families. And when you actually look at the sort of network of relationships, you can see that often a lot of the Europeans living in those areas were intermarried too with some of their neighbours, and there was a bit of a network of relatives that had relationships with Aboriginal people as well.
Mm. And that's not written about much, is it?
No, and yeah. I think it's just because people have assumed that those things didn't happen.
Yeah.
And perhaps they've always happened, but they've certainly happened a lot more in the space created in the 19th century by the government having no real policies or laws about Aboriginal people in Sydney.
Did any Aboriginal people become, for want of a better word, respectable and part of the mainstream white colonial society?
Not in those later years that we've found examples of, but they were certainly there and part of some of the activities that Europeans were fond of. For example, hunting trips. By the 1860s and 70s, it was known that you went down to Botany to get Aboriginal guides to accompany you who would essentially make your fun, because most of these guys didn't know a great deal about what they were doing, and these were the absolute experts about the terrain south of Sydney.
Mm.
So they were by no means viewed as respectable in that sense, and often their role would be talked about as simply assistants, but when you look at the records closely, it's quite clear that they're the masters of what's going on, and without them, these sort of ventures would have come back empty-handed, I suspect, a lot of the time.
There's a view, isn't there, that there was a lot of kind of vigorous racism towards the Aboriginal population throughout Australian history, and certainly that's been true in lots of episodes. How would you characterise the relationship, though? Was it, because, after all, Philip and the others came here with a charter to look after the Indigenous population. That didn't happen. But was there a more benign view towards the Aboriginal population than maybe we think?
I think what's interesting about some of the people in Sydney were that these children of convicts had come from pretty humble beginnings, and they were fortunate in their lives, but they had a bit of a culture of benevolence where they felt a responsibility to people less fortunate. And in many cases, they were childhood friends that they'd known since they were growing up. I don't know, though, they're complex people, because even the people that would be the most generous and do the most, what we would say, altruistic things, will then write letters to the editor and show quite a strong racist streak in their thinking.
Mm.
So they're complex people, but I think the kind of institutionalised and formalised racism that we're familiar with in the 20th century has really come about or been enabled by government policies like segregation and assimilation, and
rather than the direct experience.
Yeah,
contact,
look, I think if there's one thing that it teaches you when you look at it, history really up close like this, is that in many cases, if people are left to their own devices, they can figure out a way to get along. It may not be that that getting along is always to the best advantage of both parties, but it's probably better than being forced to live somewhere that you don't want to.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. It's a very interesting book. It's called Hidden in Plain View. Paul Irish has been my guest. And it's the history of that early interaction and the conclusion, perhaps not surprising, that Aboriginal people didn't, almost at the flick of a switch, disappear when whites arrived. Paul, good to talk with you.
Yes, thanks very much, Bill.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.